All right, guys, welcome to Deborah Gets Red Pilled, episode 32. I'm Adam. I am here by myself right now. Deborah is still getting ready. It's Valentine's Day 2021. Our guest needed to do some stuff with his girlfriend, so we're recording early today, and Deborah is still getting ready. So I'm going to do a quick intro with you guys, and after that we'll pause and then I'll buzz everybody in and we'll get going. Just wanted to bring up some stuff from that's been going on with the show. So I've gotten some feedback that my audio has been like way quieter than everybody else's. So I'm trying to address that. I went into the preferences on Zoom and changed some stuff around for my audio. So hopefully it comes out better. Yeah. If not, let us know. We can deal with constructive criticism. Yeah, so what else is going on? Email us at DeborahGetsRedPilled@protonmail.com. We really enjoy getting emails from you guys. It makes our day. And yeah, keep giving us podcast suggestions, guest suggestions. If you send us any suggestions, try to like keep them to people that are probably attainable for us. So if you send me one that says like, oh, you guys should get Hotep Jesus or Jesse Ventura, those guys are probably like out of our league at this point right now, possibly, but you know, I'll keep trying everybody. But yeah, if you have if you have like authors and stuff that you want us to get on, let us know. And if you can, possibly if you're like getting stuff from a book from an author or somebody like that, see if you can get us an email or some sort of contact info, because some of this stuff's like hard to find. And a lot of the time I reach out to people on Twitter, but a lot of the time you can't message people on Twitter unless they follow you. So yeah, but your suggestions are really, really good, and we want more of them. So I've been trying to kind of think of maybe what we could call the fans of the show. And what comes to my mind is the pill poppers or the pill heads, something to do with taking pills to get high. And yeah, if you guys have any suggestions, let us know. Tinfoil Hat has the Swarm. Some other shows have some other different names of their fans. Let us know what you guys want to be called. I listened to Grimerica Outlawed, the newest episode, yesterday, which is Grimerica's new second podcast. You guys should really check it out if you haven't yet. It's just, there's a separate RSS feed for it. So it's Grimerica Outlawed. And they're going to be doing more like controversial conspiracy stuff on that one, they say. And they had this guy, Ben Grundy, who's traditionally been a UFO guy. But he was on yesterday talking about like all the, or not yesterday, but the last episode. I listened to it yesterday, talking about, you know, how communism's creeping in and what it looks like around the world. And it's like kind of like they set it up like THC or Crow 777, where you get the first hour free and the second hour you got to pay for their subscription. So the first hour was so good that I went and got a subscription. It's like $6.50 a month. You guys should do it. Support those guys. They're doing a lot of really important stuff for people that are trying to be independent and not get canceled. So yeah, check those guys out. We had them on the show a couple weeks ago, and hopefully we get to talk to them again sometime in the future. What else we got? My friend Casey started a new Instagram page about Tartaria stuff in the Bay Area. So if you have any interest in that, he's going around and taking pictures in San Francisco and outlying towns of some weird stuff that doesn't look like it fits in with the narrative that's explained with it. And his page is called Golden Gate _ Starfort _ Command. So yeah, check it out. Go follow his page. And yeah, hopefully in the future we get to do some collabs with him. And I don't know. I'm thinking about maybe trying to start up another podcast with some other podcasting friends, do it a couple times a month. And yeah, I've got some people on board that want to do it, and so we'll see how that goes. So we'll always keep doing the stuff with Deborah as long as she's a functioning human, so we got at least a couple years left. But yeah, I got March scheduled out pretty good for shows coming up. I'm really excited. So let's see, in March we got, I'll give you the topics that we got. So the first one in March, maybe we're going to do some stuff about occultism. Second one in March, we're going to do Tartaria again. I'm really excited. Third one in March, we're going to be collaborating with these guys from Down the Rabbit Hole. 14th of March, the fourth episode, we've got Richard Willett from Glitch in the Code coming on. That's another great podcast. It's on David Icke's Iconic Network. He's an English guy. So we're going to talk to him about a new book he's got about mind control and how it relates to what's going on in the world today. So what else we got? Oh, Deborah's here. I'm going to make her wait in the waiting room a little bit. And then I also booked this guy, and he's going to talk to us about consciousness later on in March. And he sent me a YouTube video, and I have no fucking idea what the hell it's about. And hopefully he can explain it to me. I showed it to Deborah, and I said, if you can make any sense out of this, let me know, because I sure can't. And she got back to me, and she said she was more confused, you know, after 20 minutes than she was before she started. But I don't know. It's like a video about consciousness and mathematics. So hopefully we can get that, when that guy comes on, we'll get some more questions cleared up. All right. That's about it for an intro, guys. We got Deborah here waiting in the waiting room. Hopefully our guest shows up today, because it sucks when they don't. Oh, he just sent me a message. Okay, guys, I'm going to pause and buzz Deborah in, and our guest is going to be here in a minute. So thanks for listening, guys. We love you all. We'll be back in a minute. Hold on. All right, guys, we're back, and we have our guest here today from the Status Quo podcast. We have Matt Freeman. So I've been listening to Freeman Beyond the Wall for a long time, and that's how I discovered Matt as a guest on there. And he's going to come on today and kind of tell us his story and where he's from and how it's different from what we're used to.
Seems to be a Deborah. Common theme, man.
Yeah. How's it going, dude?
Pretty good, you know.
Yeah.
Just trying to scratch out a living.
Yeah. Same here, man. We're down to pretty much one income in the house now. So,
oh, we are too.
One and a half, you know. It so, sucks. Yeah. But Where are you at?
Ohio.
Ohio.
So like central Ohio.
Got it. What do you know about Ohio, Deborah?
Not a thing. Buckeye no. State? Is that the Buckeye State?
It sure is.
Okay. That's what I know.
Yeah. I've never been to Ohio.
I'm missing much.
Yeah. I'm in Oregon.
Okay.
Pretty close.
West Coast.
Pretty close to Portland. I spent most of my adult life in the Bay Area in California.
Okay.
And Deborah is in Marin County, California, is right across the Golden Gate Bridge from San Francisco.
Okay.
So, yeah, I think where we're from is two totally different worlds, politically, economically,
culturally,
racially, everything. So, yeah. We kind of wanted you, I listened to, I don't know if it was your last podcast or the one before that, but at one point in the show, you went over and talked about kind of what it's like where you grew up, and it was pretty emotional, and mm-hmm. you know, kind of it got me almost a little choked up, and your story is pretty incredible. So I'd love for you just to tell us, you know, about yourself and your story and kind of how it relates to where you're from and what those people that you grew up around are going through nowadays.
Sure. Okay. So I am originally from the southeastern part of the state, pretty close to the West Virginia border. And it's like the foothills of Appalachia. So culture wise, it's got a lot of kind of Southern influence, because that place was a long time ago was settled by people that were mostly transplants from like Georgia and South Carolina. They brought their culture with them. So it's kind of funny. That's how that region of the state is, how people from there, they have this a little bit of a Southern kind of accent. And it's kind of weird because it's so out of place. I mean, people think of Ohio as either the Midwest or the Northeast, depending on where you live. But excuse me. But you get people that have really a pretty thick Southern accent a lot of places, and just kind of weird and out of place. So, and of course, a lot of the culture comes along with it too. So it's this area was coal mining back in the day, but as the coal mines dried up, and as the Midwest in general started to deindustrialize in like the second half of the 20th century, because once the 1980s and the United States started importing large amounts of goods from Japan, mostly the kind of domestic manufacturing started to go into decline, and it's just gotten less and less of a percentage of the entire economy, until the point now where we don't really build a whole lot of stuff anymore. And the things that we do manufacture are typically high-end, high-tech goods, things like that. And there's just none of that manufacturing is left in that part of the state. About every single industry that is a considerable size is based off of stuff that can be shipped down the Ohio River. So there's some steel mills, some refineries, some bulk plants, things like that, a lot of oil and gas, natural gas production, pipelines, that type of thing. But that's really it. However, though, what's happened, because it's a reflection of what's happened across the United States in general, the fact that when a lot of the trade restrictions got lifted, and when globalization became a hot button, kind of when that became a household name, essentially, is that a lot of these plants, they packed up and moved overseas. And that's happened all over the country, but it's been especially obvious in that part of the state, because there's nothing else down there. I mean, the town I'm from, you had three options. You could stay there and live in poverty forever, try to open a business, lose everything you have because nobody has any money around there to support you, live in poverty forever, or you could leave. You could either go to college and take on $70,000 worth of student loan debt and maybe get a job one day, or you could join the military. So I picked option three. I ended up joining the military almost immediately after high school. I mean, it's a pretty easy choice for me anyway. I come from a military family. My dad was a Marine. My older brother's a Marine. All the way back, as long as I can trace, there's been members of my family in the military in one conflict or another. So it was always kind of something I thought I wanted to do anyway. And I used to be just your very kind of standard right winger, nationalist, Lincoln type conservative, rah, rah, America, you know, that type, we're number one type thing. And well, I enlisted in the Army in 2004 and I ended up, I was a medic. So 68 Whiskey, so I was an Army medic, and I was what's called a line medic, which means like when you think of a combat medic, like that's the job. It's because in the Army, medics have several different roles and responsibilities. They almost act like nurses in clinics, and sometimes they do administrative tasks, like they take histories and run clinics and things like that. But there's also other things you can be doing. You could be working on lab equipment. You could be working in a lab doing blood draws and analyzing samples and things like that. You can also be like I said, which is a line medic, which is essentially like the traditional combat medic you think of, but you also have some kind of administrative and clerical duties when it comes to your platoon. So anyway, people, like, it's typically kind of pretentious to refer to yourself as a combat medic. It's like having a PhD and insisting people call you doctor. So yeah. It's something to try not to do, but just for clarification there. So anyway, I deployed to Iraq. I left the United States in late 2006, and I spent a little over 14 months there. I think the grand total we spent in country was 14 months and 3 weeks or something like that.
What was, how was Iraq? Was it pretty hot at that time?
Well, that's the thing, is that the temperature has some pretty significant swings. I mean, it's miserable in the summer. I mean, it's awful. It's, you know, it's 120 degrees a lot of places. And also, of course, there's also some regional variants. Like, Iraq is a pretty big country, and depending on where you are, out in the west, it is like straight up desert, like people think of the Middle East. It's hot, arid, no rain whatsoever. However, if you get like into the capital area in the Tigris and the Euphrates Valley, I mean, there's green stuff. Like, it's kind of, actually, you know what, it kind of reminds me of Central California. The terrain's a bit scrubby, but there's still a lot of green around.
Got it.
As far as like the Baghdad area goes, and there's farms and stuff too, and there's irrigation and whatnot. And then, of course, you get down in the southern part of the country, there's straight up swamps. It's like Louisiana. Mm. Yeah, it's pretty wild. People don't think of Iraq like that. But yeah, there's like quite a bit of varied terrain. But of course, because a lot of it is kind of high desert, which is, I guess, what I would call it, it does get cold at night. So you're looking at anywhere from, you know, it'd be 120 during the day to like 75 at night, which doesn't sound like it's too big of a temperature swing until you've been sitting around 120 degree weather all day. And then you're like, oh my God, it's so cold. It's, you know?
Yeah. How was like what was going on with fighting and stuff at that time? Was it pretty intense in 2006?
Well, it depends on where you were, of course. And where we were, there'd be long periods of boredom and inaction and just nothing going on. And then maybe a week or two there where things were really crazy.
Got it.
And this is right in the middle of the surge, if you guys remember. Mm-hmm. So this was the big troop surge in 2006, where they sent, I think the grand total was something like 100,000 ground troops into Iraq. And that was to fight the Sunni insurgency that had grown up in the absence of Saddam's government. And of course, it never worked. Like, we never actually beat the insurgency. They just basically just paid them off so they would quit fighting us.
Yeah.
The whole thing was an abject failure, but it depends on where you were. Like I said, I mean, where we were in Baghdad, we got moved around quite a bit. So there were some sectors where there was absolutely nothing going on. And there were other sectors that were, you know, you would see, you get some pop shots and whatnot a couple times a week. But the biggest threat, of course, is IEDs, improvised explosive devices. And that's the main thing. People were, you know, that was a real concern for us. And like I said, it was just kind of all over the place.
Is that pretty much spots for Deborah? Is that pretty much just like a pipe bomb, like a homemade bomb that they put on like the side of the road or something like that?
Yeah, there's a bit of a range. They can go from a small homemade pipe bomb, you know, on one end of the spectrum to repurposed artillery shells. So 155 millimeters, which you think about it, 155 millimeters is about 6 inches in diameter. So an artillery shell that's that wide and weighs about 150, 180 pounds. And what they would do a lot of times, they would wire a bunch of them together and bury them. And I mean, you're talking about an explosion that is perfectly capable of destroying a Humvee or any other type of military vehicle. And then, of course, on the other end of the scale, there was not only kind of crappy, crude, homemade, improvised munitions, but there was also much more sophisticated kind of manufactured weapons, Chinese anti-tank mines. They look like a pizza box. they're about the size of a Pizza Hut pizza box. That's a good example. And also, too, there was these things called explosively formed penetrators, and this is what scared the living daylights out of all of us. And essentially what you have was, like, if you think of like a coffee can that's filled with explosive, and then on the other, not actually a coffee can, but a better example would be like a piece of pipe that has a pipe cap screwed on one end of it, and it'd be filled with explosive. And then what they would do is they would take like a thin sheet of copper and hammer it into like a concave shape. So you think of like a funnel, and they would stuff that with a press down into the pipe. So what would happen was when the charge gets lit off and that thing detonates, that copper, because it has such a low melting point, the explosion actually makes it melt. And the copper gets shot down the pipe, almost like a barrel of a gun. And essentially what happens is it turns into a giant bullet. And this bullet, when it hits an armored vehicle, it does one of two things. Either it'll punch one through one end and out the other, just like a bullet would on a piece of plywood or something like that. Or the armor will stop it from penetrating. You'll see what's called spalling, which is essentially when the material starts to form cracks and pieces of the material actually blow off the inside of the armor of the vehicle. So that would be the two ways that people would be wounded from them. And I mean, we're talking about, this is the type of thing where, like, if you get hit, even like a glancing blow from one of these things, you're going to lose a limb.
Yeah. I mean, like the secondary fragmentation, right?
Yeah. You just because of the pure amount of power, like the amount of force transferred through this thing. And we used to always do this thing whenever we'd be going through areas that were really heavily mined with these things. We'd say, okay, spread your shit out. So you take one arm and put it behind you, one arm, put it in front of you, and you try to spread your legs out as much as you can. So that way, if you got hit with an EFP, you wouldn't lose all four of your limbs.
Oh, Jesus. God.
Yeah, it's wild.
Yeah. And then, so how long were you deployed for?
I was about 15 months, give or take a couple weeks there.
Yeah.
And we stayed the entire time. We stayed inside the capital city. We were mostly in West Baghdad, which is predominantly Sunni, but we did get moved around a fair bit. We did spend some time in Baghdad, al-Jadida, which is actually this new Baghdad. And I don't know if you guys ever read the book, David Finkel's book, The Good Soldiers.
No.
Or if you've heard of it, he was the same guy wrote the book that got turned into the movie, Thank You for Your Service. That was actually also based off another book he read. But anyway, he was embedded with, I think it was the 115 Infantry, which was the unit that was responsible for Baghdad, al-Jadida, New Baghdad. And we spent a little bit of time kind of babysitting a sector that was right next to theirs when they were there. Okay. So that's a good example of frame of reference.
Got it. And then, so it's 2006, go to Iraq for 15 mm-hmm. months. You come mm-hmm. back. Are you still enlisted or do you go back home at that point?
No, I was still in the Army. I mean, I spent a couple weeks on leave, sure, you know, some post-tour leave, but yeah. I was still in the military and I was in Texas. I was stationed at Fort Hood. So that's
man.
As far away from home as you can get.
Yeah, there's some conspiracy stuff about that place recently, dude.
Oh, dude, let me tell you about that, man. I'm telling you, if they actually had any interest in getting the bottom of that kind of stuff, I promise you could go out to the ranges where people go out and maneuver vehicles and fire weapons and stuff like that. I promise you that there are bodies upon bodies upon bodies that you will find. Man. Because what happened to that Vanessa Guillen chick? Like, that's the one that kind of set the whole thing off. That type of stuff is common because people are like, oh, my goodness, this dereliction, dude, this is so terrible. It's like, nah, this is how Fort Hood operates. We would sometimes see people that would just basically just quit showing up for duty one day. And you'd think, especially if you're not a problem soldier and you got a good disciplinary record and you're happy to be there in the military, you would think if your commander notices that you go missing, he'd be like, hey, where the hell is this guy?
Yeah.
Maybe something bad happened to him. But no, what would happen is they would just mark you down as AWOL unless there was very obvious evidence that you've been kidnapped.
Yeah.
So there were multiple people that just disappeared for one reason or another, and they just got marked down as AWOL. So if you ask me, I mean, it's hard to tell what happened with some of these people, man. It could have been gangs. It could have been something like, I mean, I don't know. There's like an urban legend that all the soldiers would get told when you go down there, and they would tell you, yeah, man, if you're going to this bar, you got to watch out for these one girls, because they'll hook up with you and then tell you they want to go back to their house. But when you go back to their house, they're going to drug you and you're going to get raped by a bunch of people.
Yeah.
It's like something crazy like that. But yeah, they're honestly, though, it's probably not too far from the truth, because I mean, there's been busts for like human trafficking rings that have been busted through there. There have been a bunch of stings actually where, there was one guy who was I think he was a master sergeant, which is a pretty high ranking non-commissioned officer. He got busted for being in a prostitution ring, I believe is what it was. So, yeah. I mean, people kind of have this conception that people in the military are just upstanding young men and the pride of our nation. They would never do anything wrong. Well, nah, it's just a cross section of society, man. There's good people and there's terrible people, and all they are is just wearing the same clothes. So, to sum it up, though, I mean, I would not be surprised if there were lots of bodies buried out the ranges of Fort Hood to cover up all kinds of crimes.
Yeah, that's my friend Dean has a podcast called Up Is Down, and he did like a two episodes on Fort Hood, and yeah, he pretty much came to the conclusion that it's just a big sex trafficking ring going on from there. So
there's something about how I read that Fort Hood actually has the highest rate of sexual assault in any U.S. military base, which says something
crazy.
Did you know any of this before you went to Fort Hood?
Oh no, I essentially had the same amount of, I mean, I was completely blind with the way things were in the military. I mean, my family, like I said, you know, long military history there. And I just thought, like most people do, that the military is full of upstanding young men and people, and you can leave your car unlocked and your door unlocked in military bases and this type of thing. And no, that's not the case. There are thieves and crooks and criminals abound, just like there are in regular society. So I had no idea. And I mean, honestly, I was a little pissed I was going that far away from home. I had put in for, like, when you're getting ready to leave basic training, or AIT, which is advanced training, you can put in for your preferred postings. The Army really does try to keep people kind of close to home. Because it has to be like an open billet. And then it also has to be, which basically means there has to be a job opening of your MOS, which is your military job, at whatever base you want to go to. So, and it has to be for your correct rank too, which is going to be pretty, you know, pretty unlikely for a lot of jobs, because there's just very small numbers. But as for medics, there's tons of medics everywhere. I think it's the second most populated MOS in the military. And I put in for Fort Drum and Fort Campbell and one more. I can't remember where it was. I think it was, what was it now? It's like Fort, doesn't matter. But the point was that I was trying to stay close to home, of course, but that's not how it happened. So really, I knew nothing about the place.
Mm-hmm. Okay, go ahead, Deborah.
I was just going to say, you were there at Fort Hood for how long?
4 years total.
Ooh.
So after Fort Hood, do you get, you're discharged honorably and then you head back home?
No.
No? Okay.
No. Well, that's the second half story. So after we got back, I mean, I was okay for several months there. But after a while, I was having trouble sleeping, and essentially I just couldn't deal. I mean, it's not like we had some horrific, you know, terrible, awful, rough deployment. I mean, it did suck, and we did go through some shit, but it wasn't anything compared to what some people have to experience. So I had a lot of trouble sleeping, and what I was mostly resorting to was just heavy amounts of alcohol, and that worked well enough for a while until it didn't. But eventually, long story short, is that I had injured myself, and I had gotten one of the physician's assistants I was kind of cool with, because being a medic, you work closely with the medical platoon of your battalion. So, you know, like you'll know your unit's doctor probably pretty well. You'll know the physician's assistants. You'll know most of the nurses. So I had gotten the PA that ran our unit to write me a prescription for some prescription painkillers because I had injured myself and I really didn't want to report it to medical because I was trying to do 25 years in the Army. And any type of injury you have, whether it's mental or physical, can derail your military career, because a lot of times what will happen is that they will have somebody that's got a significant injury, or at least one that will alter your career. And instead of trying to work with you and rehab you and get you better, a lot of times, especially if you're not, if you're not anybody special, they will give you a medical separation or medical retirement. And that means that you're done. And I mean, we had seen also too, I was not going to go to mental health because I had seen time and time and time again, somebody would go to mental health because they were having some kind of problem and they would essentially get disciplined for it. They would be removed from the military. Would they be discharged? Even if it was an honorable discharge, I mean, still it's the type of thing where it's like, they're basically punishing you for admitting you have a problem. And if you are trying to get promoted and you have like an open mental health file, that stuff is supposed to be confidential, but it's really not. So there was no way I was going to go through the proper channels to actually document any type of problems I was having. And what I found though, is that once I started taking those painkillers, that magically I could sleep again. Slept great.
What,
I felt great there for.
What'd they give you?
Vicodin.
Got it.
And I felt great there for a while until I ran out. And long story short is that I tried to go back to the well a couple of times. Doctor wasn't having it. The PA wasn't having it. So I was essentially left to kind of procure my own supply and be my own pharmacist, which I decided to do. And everything was pretty much going along swimmingly. I mean, nobody really suspected anything until one day I get drug out of bed at 4 o'clock in the morning. And long story short is that I did not know this at the time, but one of the nurses in our unit had stolen a bunch of control meds. So certain drugs that medical units carry, fentanyl, morphine sulfate, Dilaudid, things like that, you know, basically controlled substances. That type of stuff is kept under lock and key, usually in a red box or a red bag. It's a drug bag. And that stuff is all controlled and documented because every time I dispense one of those medications in the field, I would number one, I have to go sign them out first. They'd have to record all the lot numbers off the bottles and how much was in each one and so on and so forth. And anytime that you dispensed one of these medications, you'd have to inform command. They'd have to write it down. There's a whole process, right? Well, it turned out the count was off from what we should have had. Somebody had been dipping their fingers into the drug supply. And they, of course, went around and drug tested everybody in the unit. And lo and behold, I'm the only one that pisses dirty for any type of drugs. So, of course, logically, I'm the one that did it, even though the drugs that I stole and the drugs that I tested for and the drugs that were stolen were totally different. But that's not really, you know, it doesn't really matter at that point. So anyway, it turned out it would be one of the nurses that actually stole some of these control drugs. But I went through this whole process of being interrogated by Army CID, which is essentially their kind of detectives, guys wearing suits and whatnot. And they were convinced that I had stolen these drugs. They tried to get me to confess to something, which I didn't even actually do. So I was, you know, more or less maintaining my innocence. And the guy's like, all right, fine. Well, look, I'll be right back. So he goes and he types up a confession on his computer, prints it out, and has me sign it. And I'm not confessing to the use or to stealing these drugs. I'm confessing to, you know, testing positive. So I'm like, well, I'll kind of bust it there. So I signed it and he's like, all right, thanks. Talk to you in a couple of days. So I kind of thought like, I'm probably going to have some extra duty or something like that. It'd be a little bit of trouble. No big deal. Nope. I get called to the battalion commander's office like a week later. And he tells me that he's going to administratively separate me from the Army, which essentially is kind of like this. You're supposed to have some protections against you being unjustly discharged from the military. But in practice, what that really means is that there's an entire backdoor procedure that they can use called administrative separation. And they can't give you like a dishonorable discharge, but they can give you what's called a bad paper discharge, which basically means you're not entitled to benefits. You don't get veteran plates. It's basically like you never did anything. And that's a process that commanders can use to remove soldiers from their command. And it wouldn't be, it wasn't just like people that tested positive for drugs. It would be people also that had like mental health problems, that they didn't want to run through the system for whatever reason. And they would, there was actually a, there's a pretty good size class action, or not class, but there's a pretty good size movement right now of guys that have been basically kicked out for having PTSD to try to get their, you know, to try to get reinstated with a honorable discharge. And they've actually, ever since Vietnam, this has been happening. And every president, excuse me, from Nixon to Carter to Ford to Reagan to Bush 1 to Clinton to Bush 2 to Obama to Trump, there's been veterans groups that have petitioned the president to just convert every bad paper discharge over to an honorable discharge. And not a single president has been willing to do it. So really tells you a lot about how much they actually care about people in the military, which is, in other words, they don't. But I mean, they just, that's the thing, man. One thing I learned is that you're essentially like a tool or a battery. They'll use you, charge you up and discharge you, charge you and discharge you until you won't hold a charge anymore. And then they throw you in the recycling. That's how they treat American servicemen and women, at least the political class does. And then they turn around and tell all of us regular people, oh, well, you know, you need to honor and respect these soldiers. And it's like, excuse me, how about you do that? But yeah. I'm just, I don't know, man. It's like, not to get too philosophical right now, but there's this one, it's kind of a corny quote, but one thing that you'll often see, there's a lot of memes on kind of like the veteran normie pages that'll be like, a veteran is some person at some point in their life wrote a check to the United States government for the amount up to and including their life. And while that's a cheesy way to put it, there is some truth in that. However, and you'd think like, so you have, if half of what the government tells us is true, right? That these people, the best, these young men and women are the best of our society. They are the pride of a nation, right? And we are so honored and proud of their sacrifice. And we're so, you know, they're so great because they're willing to give their lives to protect us. If that's really true, then the people that serve in the military, whether that was their intention or not, have given the people in power an incredible gift, you know, the willingness to sacrifice their own lives for the safety of others. And then what do the political class do to it? They will gladly throw our lives away for political gain and geopolitics. And that is absolutely infuriating to me.
Yeah. So what, so after that, you're discharged?
Mm-hmm. And I went back to Ohio after I stayed in Texas for a little while, but I eventually came back to Ohio where I was from and kind of just drifted around for a while. I mean, I did some roofing. I worked at a Firestone. I spent a little time as an EMT, but I ended up getting fired from that job too for testing positive for drugs once again. You know, it's like, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice. But
you're just like scoring pills and stuff from illegally.
Yeah. I had like some prescriptions, but they were not legitimate prescriptions. You know, they were the kind of places where it used to be back in the day that, back when OxyContin was still a thing, you used to be able to go certain places and kind of pay cash and they would write you a prescription. And it was all,
yeah, the pill mills, know, right?
Yes. It's all technically above board, but not really.
Yeah. I remember that. What was Al Gore's TV channel called? Was it Current TV or something like that?
I didn't know he had one.
Yeah. It was a while back. And it wasn't that bad. They actually had some pretty good documentaries on it, but they had one, about pill mills, and they were all in like Florida, it seemed like.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they went to, and there was like a whole like strip of them on like one street, so you could, and there was like no, they didn't communicate with each other, so you could keep going and get, they were like pain clinics, you could keep going and getting prescriptions filled at each of them. Right. And they showed the parking lots of them, and they were like filled with like Ohio, West Virginia, and it was like all the way in like the middle of Florida, like people had traveled that far to get pills, you know.
Yeah, that sounds about right, man. It's that I used to actually go patronize some places like that too in Florida. Yeah. No doubt. And yeah, you just pay cash essentially, and you pretty much walk out with whatever that place was offering. That, you know, the doctor would walk in, say, hi, how you doing? He'd look in your mouth and write you a prescription and you'd be on your way.
And what are they giving you at those places? Mostly OxyContin.
Yeah, it used to be you get, I think it was nine, one place it was 90 OxyContin 80s and then 90 Percocet 10s and then I think some Valiums and Somas too when they were still around.
Wow.
So yeah, I mean, it's certainly like just way more prescription medication than anybody who's, you know, 25 years old could ever possibly need unless they were missing limbs or, you know, they were born with like muscular dystrophy or something like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, man. So that was kind of how, that was certainly how that whole thing started, was just the reckless overprescription of drugs by, you know, medical practitioners. But it's not just that too. And I think something that happens a lot when you hear this issue talked about in the mainstream, they typically want to put it all on the doctors that write these prescriptions, where it's like, yeah, I mean, that's half of it. Sure. But there's another half too. That's just the supply side. What about the demand side? I mean, number one, we all have to be responsible for our own actions. I am, if nothing else, I'm a man of my own actions. I mean, you know, like I dug myself a deep asshole years ago, but that's okay though, because you know what? That also means I have the power to dig myself out of it.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so you have to hold people responsible for the things they do, because we are all autonomous beings. We have full control over our bodies and what we do, you know, for the most part. However, though, there's a confluence of kind of cultural and social and economic factors in this part of the country that are why drug abuse and especially opioid addiction is so bad here. And it's the fact that there's really no future for so many people around here. I mean, essentially, there's a whole generation of guys that had good paying industrial jobs that were kind of expecting that golden watch the one day, that retirement, that pension. They never got it, and they were never able to adjust afterwards. And then people that grew up in Appalachia today, essentially, what they see is they only, like I said in the beginning, you only have a couple options. Stay here and waste away to nothing until the day you die and become a ward of the state, go to college and become buried in debt, or go to the military. And one thing that people kind of, I think if people that are not from here, I think something that they don't realize how much of an impact it makes is that the people that go and fight in these wars, by and large, they're from rural parts of the country. It's something like 60-40. And if you look at how many urban areas there are in the United States, what that means is that rural poor, especially poor rural whites, are disproportionately overrepresented in the United States military. And that's for several reasons. Number one is, I mean, there's like some historical things there, but really that's one of the few jobs you can go get that you don't have to have any experience for, that actually pays you halfway decent. And also, I can't tell you how many people in the Army that I met that said, I'm just here because it was the only way I could get out of this small town I was in. So many people I know said that. So what that means is that the last 20 years of warfare has had an enormous impact on these communities. I mean, it was back when I was still in. I mean, you drive through my town and you'd see yellow ribbons tied on every tree. They'd have the banners on the streetlight poles. It had like the names of soldiers and people that served that lived in that community. You know, parades and whatnot, the local carryouts and high schools. They had like the pronto signs that had like the letters you can slide on. They'd always say, "Welcome home, Staff Sergeant so-and-so," or "Welcome home, blah, blah, blah." And so what that means is that not only like the combat deaths, it's not only the killed in actions, but it's also the suicides, the broken families, the divorces, the emotional trauma. All that stuff guys bring it home with them. They bring it back into the communities, and it affects every single person that cares about them, that come in contact with. So it's just like ripples. I mean, even something as simple as a guy, you know, gets his legs blown off in Iraq, comes home, right? He's married. So he's got PTSD, severe emotional and physical problems. His wife can't deal. They get divorced. You know, he might go blow his brains out. Now his parents got, you know, his parents and his brothers and sisters got that to deal with. His kids growing up without a dad. I mean, it's just the problems that it causes just compounds. And I mean, we're not going to fully realize the cost of these wars till 50 years down the line. And I think once people are actually have enough distance to where they can actually see how costly they have been, we're just, I hope we'll just say like, oh my goodness, how could we be so stupid to let this crap go on for so long? But the bottom line is that the amount of impact these things have, you know, like I live in the city now. I don't live where I used to, where I grew up. I live in the city now and I don't really see it. Not like I did down there.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I wanted, yeah. The main reason that I wanted to bring you on after I heard you talk on the last episode, on your last episode, was because, you know, where Deborah and I are from, especially where Deborah's from, there's no, in California, like in the Bay Area part that we're from, there's no real impoverished class of white people. There's right. poor people there, but they're usually yeah. Racial minorities. And it seems pretty foreign to us. I moved to, especially if I know that there is that out in rural areas all over the place. There probably is in California as well. But yeah, it was a wake up call for me when I moved to Portland, Oregon from there. There's like generational, like poor white people in a city setting here, which was really weird to us. But yeah, so I had a bunch of stuff like are you open to talking about
of course.
Going to prison or anything like that?
Yeah, man, sure. And Deborah, I'll just give you a quick rundown of how I came to be there. And essentially, I mean, it's probably not hard to figure out at this point. I mean, I eventually got caught dealing drugs to support my habit. And, you know, I kind of thought foolishly that the judge would kind of give a crap about my military service. And, well, turned out he really didn't. So what had happened is that I had, basically there was this thing that was set up. A friend of mine got arrested leaving my house with some pain pills that he had purchased for me. And in exchange for his own freedom, he volunteered to wear a wire on me. And that's essentially what happened. And got arrested. You know, the cops, essentially, the only reason I'm not dead probably today is because I lived in a house that had this big, long gravel driveway out in the country. And I saw a couple Lenco Bearcats, these big, heavy armor vehicles, and a couple cop cars driving down my street or driving down my driveway. And obviously, like, it was what they called the Major Crimes Task Force, which is essentially this kind of these jump out boys, like these, you know, SWAT team and a bunch of over caffeinated, steroided out cops that live to arrest people. And the only reason I'm probably alive is because I saw them coming, because they kicked in my door. And I mean, I ran at this point, but if I used to always sit with a rifle next to me, and I mean, you know, I mean, I was certainly not of in a healthy mental state at this point in time in my life. So I mean, if they would have kicked in my door and I wouldn't know it was the cops, I mean, who knows what would have happened? I'd probably be dead, most likely, you know, or doing life in prison, one of the two. But anyway, I did see them coming, and I ran. They shot my dog. Eventually, I got arrested. It was only a few minutes later, but I was charged with trafficking in drugs, a couple felonies, and I pled guilty pretty much because I mean they really had me dead to rights. There's really very little I can do. And one thing I have noticed actually that I don't know if you guys have seen this or not, or even paid attention, because, you know, like if you're not having to deal with the justice system, why bother looking at it, you know? But there's a very uneven kind of application of the law that happens. And one thing that happens, I think, is in bigger cities, there's real crimes there. There's like murders and gangs and rape and all that kinds of stuff. But out in rural areas, you know, that you might live in a county that has 500 criminal cases a year, and most of them are kind of petty crime, like theft and, you know, larceny and crap like that, non-payment of child support. So what happens then is that when people get charged with I can get charged with a felony in a small town and get maxed out. I could get the max number of years in prison. But if I got charged with that same crime in the city, where the caseload's so much higher and there's so much less jail space, that person might, you know, they might get probation or maybe even just get it dismissed for a future indictment. So what happens then is that if you get caught committing a crime in a small town, you're much more likely to get punished severely. And that's pretty much what happened to me. I mean, I pled guilty, but I still got the maximum penalty you could get under the law, which was 3 years in prison. And yeah, I mean, it's probably, you know, something that if I lived then where I do now, I probably wouldn't even seen the inside of a jail cell, but I didn't. So I got sent up there for 3 years.
Where'd they send you?
It's a place called Ross Correctional Institution, which is it's part of Southern Ohio. And essentially what that is, it's called a level 3 prison facility. So it's kind of like a maximum security, but not quite. I mean, there's cells and whatnot. And you think, you know, nonviolent crime, like what was I doing there? And well, long story short is that I had came into prison with some nice shoes. And one of the laws about prison in Ohio is that if you have like some shoes that meet these particular criteria when you come in, they'll let you keep them instead of just giving you like the state issued shoes, which, I mean, you can also buy shoes from the commissary there. But basically I had some nice shoes, and I'm pretty sure that a couple guys that were in the cell house with me wanted them. So they, I believe, planted a knife in my cell and told the CEO. So I got in trouble for that. And I got my security raised from medium to essentially maximum. And I spent the first year and a half of my prison sentence in like a high security place where, you know, it's full of like rapists and murderers and gangbangers, all kinds of stuff like that. It's not drug users and that type of thing is who gets sent there. So yeah, I ended up spending 3 years inside. And I mean, it's, I don't know. One of the ironies is that military is just, it's just prison without bars. It's really the biggest difference I can see.
Yeah. So you do 3 years, you get out, and then do you head back to Southern Ohio, or do you have to go there for to parole and do all that stuff?
I spent the first 6 months in a halfway house, which is in Southern Ohio. And I lived there just long enough for me to get out and go somewhere else. And that's exactly what I did, is I ended up moving up to Columbus, like capital.
Yeah.
And that was what really enabled me to break the cycle. I was just able to get away from that whole area. And it's just like the people I went to school with when I left to go to the military, they were doing something. You know, they were nothing great. When I came back home from the Army, they were doing the same thing. And when I got out of prison and came back, they were doing the same damn thing, which is basically watching their lives passing by, not really doing anything constructive with them. And I didn't want that for myself. So I ended up moving out. And it's only with leaving that place behind, I've actually been able to do something positive in my life.
Yeah. So let's say, you know, 2014, 2015 comes about, Donald Trump emerges as candidate for president. Uh-huh. How are the people from Southern Ohio viewing him, and what does he mean for that community?
Oh yeah, man. Well, that's actually, yeah, something I was discussing with my girlfriend, because she could not get past why people supported Donald Trump. And yeah,
she's from a different place than you, right?
Yeah, she's from the city.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's to understand it, it's like you just have to understand a little bit about the culture of the area and the history behind it. And yeah, like when Trump announces candidacy for president, I mean, almost instantly you saw MAGA signs go up everywhere and people wearing MAGA hats and so on and so forth. Like every time I go down and visit my family, I'd see Trump signs everywhere and whatnot. And it's the type of place where it's like there's Bible verses on billboards. And I can't remember the exact words. I wish I could, but there's one Bible verse I thought was rather ironic. It was like an American flag and a bald eagle and a Bible, but it had, it was something about how there's only one. I can't remember. I think it was in Ephesians, but it was a Bible verse essentially about how there's only one true God, and it's juxtaposed with this American flag and this bald eagle, which are two things that people also worship. But yeah, I thought that was a little strange. But anyway, so it's the type of place where, you know, there's Bible quotes on billboards, and basically, yeah, people were Trump was their guy. I've never seen a political candidate get that kind of reception down there. Not even the Bushes. You know, it's kind of like Bushes, they were accepted because they were Republicans and, you know, not Democrats. But that's about as much as people cared back then. But Donald Trump, though, there was a whole nother level. And here's where I think why is that, I mean, things are pretty bleak. And, you know, it's not like living in a third world country by any means, but it's certainly you could look around, especially like if you're a little older, you might be able to look around and you think to yourself, like, man, things used to be way different down here. What the hell happened? And this guy comes along, and what's he say? He says that he's gonna bring back your jobs, right?
Yeah, well, he's talking about restoring the coal industry, and Hillary Clinton's talking about ending coal forever, right?
Yeah, that's something that was really ironic too, is that you know, Trump would go through towns, and he actually came through a couple places here. He would come through and say, like, I'm gonna get your jobs back, so, you know, we're gonna, China's taking our lunch, so on and so forth. And then Hillary Clinton would come behind him and say, how offensive is this guy? You know, she's just like totally out of touch with people there. And I mean, it's not really surprising. And of course, Donald Trump is too, but at least he had somewhat of his finger on the pulse of what was going on. But anyway, yeah. Long story short is that, yeah, I mean, people's biggest complaint down there has long been economic. Rightly or wrongly, they tend to blame immigrants and the Chinese for taking their jobs. And I mean, you know, it's easy to see why when the factory that you worked for 20 years got moved to India and you can't find anything else. There's really nothing else you can do. You're upside down in your mortgage, so you can't really move. You can't sell your house because it's not worth anything near where you paid for it. So people, you know, they get stuck. And unfortunately, not everybody has the drive and ability to really dig themselves out of holes like that. Unfortunately, whether they should be able to or not is really beside the point. The point is that they look to DC, to politicians, to solve their problems. Now, of course, if you do that, you're always going to be disappointed, but that doesn't change the fact that people still do so. So yeah. And of course, the other big issue that Donald Trump ran on was that the Iraq war was stupid. We never should have fought it. And, you know, Barack Obama was an idiot for not pulling us out of it, so on and so forth.
And Hillary Clinton's talking about going into Iran. So,
yeah, and Libya, and, you know, and Syria, and all these other places. And while you don't have the degree of anti-war sentiment you would hope for in these places yet, at least I don't see it like that. But for most part, if you do get people talking down there, especially if they have family that have served in the military, they are acutely aware of how all these international, you know, adventures have been an abject failure. People are very aware of that. And there is a real fatigue for fighting these wars in general, especially among people who's, you know, they're much closer to the military than the average person, because that's actually a huge problem in our society too, is that there's such a disconnect between the civilian sector population, which, I mean, I don't like using that word, but I just can't think of a better one. There's such a disconnect between the civilian population and the military in our country, which is not a good thing. You saw that happen in ancient Rome too, after the Roman Republic became the Roman Empire, and, you know, it ended up contributing largely to the decline of the civilization. But people in this country, there's such a chasm between the military community and the civilian community, is that it's not seen the way it should be. And fact of the matter is that people that have some proximity to it, they're by and large kind of just tired of the same old shit. I mean, it's been 20 plus years of the same thing. And where I'm from, it's been 20 plus years of people watching their kids go off, you know, to basic training. They come back wearing their class A's, wearing their dress uniform, and they're all happy and proud. And then they get deployed and they're never the same, if they come back at all, you know, where they sit and they watch them go through a lifetime of binge drinking and drug abuse, divorce, you know, child abuse in some cases, suicide. I mean, it's just, it's not everybody. There's a large percentage of people in the military that go through it and it ends up being the best experience of their lives. But that's not universal by any means. There's a flip
side. I would wonder what kind of life they had that the military seemed like an improvement.
Well, I mean, if you do it right, it can set you up for good things later in life. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think it was all negative for me. Honestly, I wouldn't change it if I could, because it made me who I am. It made me really understand like the value of what I do have in life. But also, it's just, you know, there's really something to be said about seeing how other people in the world, about how they live. And you realize, like, America's got a lot of problems, but we are fortunate in a lot of ways here to live the way we do. I mean, the poor people in our country, they have big screen TVs and cell phones by and large.
Yeah, the poor people here are fat.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Which, I mean, that partly is because of all the processed garbage that we make cheap because of corn subsidies and whatnot, but still they have food to eat. Yeah, the poor people in Iraq are skinny. Yeah. You know?
Man. So yeah, what do you think, Deborah? Does that clear up a little bit on, you know, I know it's hard when we don't see this type of living situation, you know, immediately around us. Does it explain a little bit why, you know, 84 million people voted for Donald Trump?
Sure it does. Yeah. I mean, you know, your life's not working and the government's not doing, you know, anything that it says it's going to do in your behalf. And, you know, here comes this guy who's going to switch it all up and bring everybody's jobs back. And yeah, it's seductive. You want to believe.
Yeah. And it's not much different from people in, like, say, the inner cities who are voting Democrat because they're being promised, mm-hmm. you know, welfare. Absolutely. And things like that, and free housing and all that stuff. It's like one.
It's a very good observation. So never even thought of it that way.
Yeah.
But I mean, and if I could, I don't know. It's just frustrating too, because it's you finally start to see people kind of question the system and kind of start to realize that things are not, there's real problems here. And maybe the two-party Republican Democrat kind of consensus is really not working out for the regular person. You're starting to see people kind of question that. And then when they do, they just turn and essentially they go kind of gravitate towards this guy who basically just becomes more of the same with a little different rhetoric. And unfortunately, it's just, I don't know, man. It's just one of those things where it's like, if you're looking for the solution to your problems, you know, at a third party, you're never going to get them. And if I could just give a message that everybody in America would receive, if it would just go in, if they would just hear it and accept it and understand it, it would be that you are responsible for your own problems. And it's like, we have this huge problem in our society, man. It's like The Simpsons they had this one episode, Homer, he just said, "This is everybody's fault but mine." It's like, that's the attitude that we have as Americans today. And unfortunately, there is nothing more disempowering than saying that, because the beauty is that if everything is your fault, if the fact that where you are in life is your fault, that's good. Because you got yourself in that mess, that means you can also get yourself out of it. I mean, if I started 7 years ago as, you know, an ex-convict with $75 and a pair of gray sweatpants, and I can get to where I am now, I mean, it is possible. It's not easy, but it's doable.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I remember, you know, I don't have like a similar story, but I struggled with, you know, alcohol and drugs for mm-hmm. a long time. And I don't anymore. But I remember, like, you know, getting to the rock bottom and just, you know, I got in a real bad gnarly motorcycle crash when I was really, really drunk and went to jail. And I remember getting out and the next day, just like being like, well, that, you know, finally realizing that was it, you know, and like the relief that came from being like, from just like giving up and then like starting to dig myself out was
exactly.
Such a good feeling. And like, you know, it was scary. I didn't have anything. I was broke. You know, I was having a hard time paying rent, everything like that, you know, but it was just empowering to be able to just like give up.
Yeah.
So,
and you took the responsibility for your problem, and that's I think that's probably largely why you got out of it.
Yeah. And yeah, man, this is really good, Matt. I really, really,
definitely,
really appreciate it.
Yeah, glad to talk to you guys.
Yeah, and it's pretty cool. Like, I think, you know, when you start taking that responsibility for yourself, you kind of end up, you like, I still like listening to politics and being involved sure. with it. But it's funny that the people that are like the most have their finger on the pulse the most on both sides end up being like the ones that don't participate in it at all, you know? So
right.
I consider myself an anarchist, but I don't think I'm well read enough and do enough research to actually like claim that. So I'd call myself an agorist because I know how to build a chicken coop and like work mm-hmm. on motorcycles and do yard work and stuff and like tell the cops to fuck off. So that's what I'd rather do all that than read Man, Economy, and State, you know, or something like that.
Well, I think it's important. I think actually something that we see kind of like in the liberty movement a little too much is like, hey, yeah, the intellectual foundation is important, but it's not number one. It's not going to get us all the way there. Because we've had, you know, 50 plus years of fantastic philosophy and great books and whatnot. And it hasn't moved things in any positive direction at all. But also too, man, it's like that stuff only gets you so far. Number one is that I think the best way to spread liberty and freedom, I've actually been thinking about this a lot. I got to go out to this too, guys. My phone's almost dead. But okay. I think the best way to spread liberty and freedom and the desire for these things in other people is by learning hard skills and things like gardening and stuff like that. I mean, being yeah. able to remove yourself from the system as much as possible.
Yeah.
That's the way to do it.
Yeah. As well, I'll give you one more quote. It's not a direct quote, but it's Eric July. He says something like, we need the guys in bow ties and we also need the motherfuckers in hoodies too. So
yeah, that's a good one.
Well, Matt, I'm going to let you go. Tell your girlfriend thanks for letting us do this on Valentine's Day. We really appreciate it. And we really hope to talk to you again sometime
yeah,
soon.
Yeah, you have a great yeah, story, and I'd love to hear more.
Sure.
Tell everybody where they can find you.
Okay, so the best place to find me is the website, for the most part. That is thestatusquo.net. And Twitter handle is the same, Status Quo Pod, Status with the T. Podcast is on all the major podcatchers, Apple, Stitcher, Google Play, so on and so forth. That's pretty much the only place that we are these days.
Got it, man.
Cool.
Yeah, it was great. Thanks, oh, yeah. man. Let's talk again. And we'll talk to you later, man. Peace.
Sounds good, guys.
Love you, Deborah.
Thank you. Bye. Love you, Adam.
See you guys. All right, guys. We're out. Thank you.
Thank you.